So welcome everybody to Secrets of Desperate Performers. This is like a sort of loose panel game, discussion game, where I ask the performers generic questions, and this might turn into a discussion, it might not, but when you look bored, or you look a bit like bemused because it gets a bit technical, I'll stop it and get you to vote on who's been the most honest. So each one is incredibly different, the makeup's very different. Mike Belgrave, he's trying to put in 7 shows today. And he's obviously running late with one of them because he should have been here at 1. So he'll swan in when he turns up. He'll
probably he's trying to break the record of the most number of shows done.
That's right. He's trying to break a record thing, and I think he's doing it by doing a quarter of each one of his, which is cheating. Just going to tell Mike that. So Mike will be sitting there, I presume, when he stumbles in. This is Brian Damage, who's part of a double act, Brian and Crystal, who also run some, could I say, Notorious?
Yes.
International. Hello, people, move down the front as much as possible, please. Otherwise you won't be able to hear us. That'd be lovely. Come and sit right in the front if you want to. We don't have a go at the audience. Come and sit down here and just relax. So Brian's part of a double act with Brian Crystal, and that you've got a club in Australia, club in London, and they run a very popular... By comics, it excludes audience if at all possible. At the Holyrood Tavern down the road, is that correct?
That's right.
Yep. Went there last night. It's fantastic. It's street, isn't it? It's with the homies of the comic.
We don't need comedy or laughter or audience to make it successful. We have a great time on our own. We just sit and stare at each other. It's fantastic. So we've got sort of 3 highly unsuccessful comedy clubs, and we have a great time. Until the audience comes in and spoils it for everybody. So
you're building upon lack of success with even greater lack of success.
An empire of lack of success. And proudly so as well.
It sounds like something that would understand as a business model.
And this is Andrew J. Lederer, who lives in New York, stand-up comic, who's doing a 5-star show.
It's not a 5-star show.
I saw 5 stars
4.
Attached to review.
4.
Oh, maybe it's my eyesight.
Yeah.
It was very successful.
I made them blurry a little bit so that people who have difficulty with their vision might think that it was a 5-star show.
And what's the name of the show?
Well, I have 2 shows. The important show, because it's the one on which I'm losing tremendous amounts of money. It's also the one with the really good reviews, is Andrew J. Lederer, Me and Hitler. Nightly at 9:25 p.m. at the Baby Belly in Cowgate. And the other one is called Anthology. We also got 4 stars, but that was the only review we got. It's just an easy, it's the Free Fringe, it's down the street, it's on at 1:45 p.m. and it's comedians telling stories from their lives, and packs every day with wonderful people because they're not paying anything. I mean, that's not why they're wonderful, that's why it's packed. And you know, sometimes I don't have any acts on at all except for me and just indulge myself, so it's, you know, it's kind of like you know, I just do what I want and, you know, let the audience, you know, stone me.
Yeah, or not even bother to show up.
Yeah, well here they'll show up every day for this show because it's free. It's a beautiful thing, they come to see free. As long as you even are alive, they feel they've gotten value for their money.
Very good. And then on the end is Lynn Parker, promoter, producer. Organizer, producer, basically maestro behind the Funny Women brand and competition. And would you like to talk a bit about that, Lynn?
Yeah, well, unlike these two guys, I'm totally commercial about it because I'm investing an awful huge amount of time and money into promoting Funny Women.
Well, that was your first mistake.
Yeah, it is, but it's working. We do 2 things. We promote women. We provide a platform for women to perform in the comedy world, exclusively women, because, as I'm sure you are aware, I have no problem with it, but I mean, I just would like to even out the odds a bit for women and just see more women in comedy, in stand-up specifically. So we run a competition for women, which is now 3 years old, Funny Women Awards, and it's our 2nd year at the Fringe, with Funny Women at the Fringe, and this year we're taking Funny Women on tour around the country. Our other secondary but equally important remit is that in addition to providing the platform for women to perform, we also do some charity fundraising and awareness raising for female-oriented charities. And we've donated money to cancer charities, while we're up here in Scotland, we're collecting for the YWCA Scotland and a cervical cancer charity called Jones Trust. So that's a kind of secondary thing, but it all ties in, because by having the charity side, women who might not have performed because they're a bit nervous about it think, oh, what the hell, I'll do it. It's, you know, it's for charity. So it does serve a purpose as well. But it's not the prime focus. We're not in it as a charity. We're in it commercially as well.
Now, when you do your shows, when you advertise them, do you put the word funny in quotation marks? You know, because, you know, well known that women aren't funny.
Who's going to hit him? Me or you? Women aren't very funny, and we've proven it. So I'm not even going to get into that argument.
I'm just being
You've got
popular.
Sabrina on the left hand side. She's bigger than me.
You know. Andrew's seen me bloody storm a gig once.
But I didn't believe it, though.
That's the problem, isn't it?
I am planning my
Belgrave.
Yeah.
What, a bit of round of applause for Mike Belgrave. Who's my only...
I love you, Sabrina.
I know you do. What number gig is this?
The first one got cancelled.
Oh, no. So you're going to break the record?
Yeah, I've got about 19 I could possibly do.
Could you please tell these lovely people what you're doing?
Hello, everyone. My name's Mike Delgrave. I'm a stand-up comedian. I've had about a million cups of coffee and 3 hours sleep. Now, what I'm doing is I'm going to try and break the record for the most amount of gigs done in a 24-hour period. Oh, I'm knackered. I've been running here. And basically, the record is 14. It's been done by a poet. And I'm going to do... I've got about 19 booked, possibly, that I can do. One's been cancelled already. This is my second one already. Thank you.
And you count this as a gig?
Yes, of course.
Is it going to be funny?
I hope so. I just made them laugh when I fell over.
Now, why are you doing this?
I made you laugh because I've got the bag behind me.
Oh, okay.
Did you, by the way, where do you weigh in on the are women funny issue?
Don't go there.
Have you? Is that what you've been talking about?
Well, I run Funny Women. So, we're just having a controversial... I mean, it's not controversial, I have to say. We've had this argument for the last 3 years, which is why I refuse to enter.
It's some dry, it's really old, tedious, boring. North American, yeah. Bald man.
Yeah. Funny Women.
North American have the nicest skulls. Let me tell you something, little missy. I think women are... my shows are almost entirely composed of women when I put them together in New York.
I know.
But that's mostly so because I don't want any competition. But these are the jokes.
It's true, though. You're winding Lynn up. He's actually very female-friendly, despite the appearances. He looks like someone from the Addams Family or something, doesn't he?
It will be resolved when we launch Funny Women in the North America next year, so, you know.
We can put Andrew in a wig.
Can stand more laughter.
Right, I'm going to ask my first question now. Yeah. By the way, I'm Sabrina George, and I'm running a gig here at at 7:10 called Crime Comedy and Me. Please come. It's been very, very beautiful review. I might even read it out later.
Yeah.
Lovely
we'll go
review.
On.
Yeah,
yesterday.
Go on.
Oh, so nice. I'll do that later. Mike Belgrave, can you tell me the pivotal point when you stopped thinking about being a performer and turned into one and actually took action on it?
What, actually, when I was on stage and, you know...
No, when you actually sort of... I don't know what you did. People do different things. Go to college and do drama or wrote a play or... I don't know what
I went
you
to
did.
College and when I had...
I'm asking Mike...
Oh, no, it's good because I'm kind of trying to... He's giving me an example of what I'm supposed to answer. Remember, I've run in, I didn't get the beginning bit of it. So what you want to do is... What made me want to do stand-up comedy, basically?
No, what action... What was your first thing that turned the action? Sometimes it's that last pizza they flung at a nasty customer. Sometimes it's just watching a really bad open mic spot. Whatever it is, what was the thing that turned you from thinking about being a performer into actually being, you know, taking that action?
Oh, what, really going for it, as opposed to just, you know, mucking around the open mic spot? I think what it might have been, actually, was when Jeff Whiting, believe it or not, I know everyone likes to laugh at him, but no, Jeff Whiting, he gave me a gig, like in, I think, Bournemouth, and it was just over a year ago, and I think that was when I was on stage and I was being paid, and there was about 150 people in the audience, and I actually stood back while the other actors were on and thought, this is what being a real comedian's like. And I think at that moment then I really started, right, that's it, no more full-time work, I only work 2 days a week, really push it with the children's entertaining, that's what I do to earn more money and just really go for anything, really, just take any gig, and that's why I'm doing 18 gigs in one day.
So what was your leap from being a children's entertainer into being a stand-up comic?
No, I kind of do both side by side.
What was it that got you into it?
Oh, into children's entertaining. I used to work in a library, and it used to have a children's night, children's under five session, and I used to just help out, and I used to bring my guitar with me, because literally about 100 people would turn up for this coffee morning, so you actually end up being like almost, you'd carry your guitar like this through the crowd and stuff, and they'd be cheering. And so I went off to another library doing the same act, and then everyone started booking me for shows, because they kind of went, wow, where's this guy come from? And I just sort of built it up and started learning how to balloon model. I got a puppet, I read stories, and that's how it came about.
And then from there to comedy?
Yeah, well, actually, I used to do comedy about 10 years ago. I was really rubbish at it, though. I was terrible. I was awful. And then about 5 years later, one day it just occurred to me where I was going wrong. It's actually writing jokes. No, believe it or not, a lot of people do that. You must see this with new comedians. They walk on stage and they're really entertaining, but they don't actually say anything funny. They just come up with these amusing concepts, and all you do is you sit there listening for 10 minutes, smiling, but there's no one laughs.
That's what I do.
Is that what you do? Yeah. No laughs.
No, there are laughs, but at my expense.
Yeah. Okay.
No
jokes. No.
So, Andrew, what was your pivotal point that took you from thinking about being a performer to actually take an action on it?
I'm not certain it's occurred yet. Pivotal point. I always wanted to be a comedian, or, you know, from like the time I was like 6 years old or something. So I watched TV with my parents, and there were comedians on TV, and I wanted to do that. And there was never any question in my mind that I would do that, or I would sing, or I would act, or I would do some combination of those things. And my parents tried to dissuade me with cool parenting techniques and Judaic misery-inducing magic. But it was, sadly, to no avail, considering that they were right in all of their dire predictions.
So what was the pivotal
there
moment?
There was no
did
pivotal
you wake
moment.
Up on,
I was a little kid, I saw comedians
on stage.
You mean, why did I go on the stage? I was waiting my whole life for the chance to go on the stage. At a certain point, I got to the point where I knew there were places you could go where you could perform, so I went to them. And once that happened, I dropped out of college, and I didn't ever do anything except for that again. Well, that and brood.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Lynn? What was the pivotal point where you decided to get your toe in the water and do this ridiculous job of being a promoter?
Well, I'm not a performer, not professionally.
Well,
anyway.
That's evident.
For me, it was seeing. I was actually involved in promoting a new club, strangely, an American club that was going to be launched in the UK. It was launched in the UK, called the Improv, and they took over a venue in London, and I was hired in to do the publicity for it. And I was probably rather, in a female and middle class way, rather shocked that there were so few women that were ever booked. And just thought, I kept asking questions and saying, why don't you ever book any women? Aren't there any funny women about? And subsequently, the gentleman concerned actually around Edinburgh this year, and I keep reminding him that he fired me. And there were two things that happened. I got fired from the account because the people changed. And at the same time, I came up with the idea of Funny Women and took 2 years to get it off the ground. And like Andrew, I was brought up on British radio comedy and just loved it. Always
well,
been
I
interested
wasn't brought up on British radio comedy.
No, but on listening to comedy and watching comedy on TV and in England as opposed to America. Okay? Not American comedy. I just loved it, you know, and the family were interested in it. No one was particularly a performer. I don't know, comedy genes, I suppose.
I know why you did it. You did it because you're a visionary person, and you sat there and you got bitter and angry that there was a gender imbalance. So you said, I'm going to fix this. And because you have the patience and the focus that gives you... See, comedians, they don't have... Trust me. Yeah, I waited my whole life to be a comedian because I was a kid. But the comedians typically are not the kind of personalities that can take 2 years to build something.
No.
So you know, people like you who actually are capable of constructing something, seeing it over there, and then bit by bit by bit building it like Mike Belgrave's jokes. It's a staggeringly impressive thing. And despite the fact that I've been mocking you and interrupting,
I'm used to it.
I think you're extremely hot babe.
I was waiting 50 years to be called a hot babe.
And what about you, Brian? What was your pivotal moment?
Well, I was basically a pub musician for years. I have been for many years. And I never wanted to be in the background. I started off as a drummer and then I became a guitarist because I wanted to go out the front and show off. And I could never sing very well, and I just found that if I sang a stupid song, I could get a great reaction, whereas I've always been envious of somebody who could actually get up here, sing a song, and make you cry or whatever, just get an extreme reaction. So for me, it was... my parents were pub musicians, and but I discovered that if you worked on your own, you did all the singing and playing, that you got all the money in a pub. And I found that it was a great way of avoiding a day job. So I would do three or four nights a week. But the one thing I didn't want to do was to stand in the corner and be ignored. So I would play in pubs where people were, you know, had no intention of getting involved at all. So I was very vicious at the time, and I was really vicious. And I would batter them over the head with jokes and stupid songs and talk a lot of rubbish in between the songs. And that's basically how it started.
And what was your day job?
Before, you mean?
Yeah, because that's a night job, isn't it?
I used to sell Burberries to chavs.
Real ones?
Used to work for Burberries.
Oh, you actually work for Burberries?
Yes, in the Haymarket, yes.
Oh, really posh.
And I got really depressed. So,
you've never worn a suit since, have
you? So I ran away with the girl in the tie department.
What's a chav?
A chav. White trash.
Oh yeah.
I didn't know that. I mean, that was in the 80s. They used to come in then, you know. And, our customers, English people, would never buy Burberrys because they'd wait for the sale, and we used to put. I've got to be careful with this.
There might be someone from Burberry in there.
Yeah,
that's true, actually. Yeah.
Well,
it could be sponsored by Burberry.
They make the trench coats that are supposed
that's
to be
right.
definitively English.
Yes. Yeah, with the lining.
That's
yeah.
it. As worn by the royal family and American presidents and
spies
whatever.
And news people. And stuff.
That's it. Yeah. And we used to sell those. But these fellows used to come in, and they wanted the raglan style, not the trench coat. I thought if you were nice and slim and quite sexy, that you'd probably have the trench coat, because they look really cool, you know, Humphrey Bogart. But no, they used to come for the raglan, which I associated with older men. But the young fellows used to
What's
come
What's a
along.
Raglan?
It's just a slit. The sleeve is
inset
not joined
sleeve.
Here.
Inset.
It comes from here.
Uh-huh.
Inset. As
so if you're
inset, isn't that when you sleep with your sister?
Exactly, yes.
I think a lot of those people did wear raglans, actually. There is definitely a connection.
Cardigans down
there. There is, and I didn't know at the time. It was just every now and then you get a gang of young fellas that come and go, what Burberry? And they go, what kind? That one. And so you'd get it for him, you go, you know, you're not going to wear a jacket with it, right? You know, it looks a bit odd. No, for it. And they just had this particular fashion in mind, even then, in the 80s.
So what was your leap from that into comedy, to actually going to a comedy club?
I embarrassed myself, really, because at the time, when I used to batter people around the head with these jokes, they were all old jokes. I had the best collection of jokes that you could imagine.
Bernard Manning.
It was wonderful. Yeah, they were killer. I had everybody's best jokes, so I just collected all these jokes, and I could get a crowd anywhere. And they were all sort of obscure. So I could get a crowd, any kind of crowd who didn't want to listen, I'd get them straight in, no problem. But then when I went and did that on my first appearance in a alternative comedy club, I had, because I found this place, it was down at the Greyhound in Sydenham, and I saw fantastic acts down there, and I thought, this is really wonderful, and I want to do this. So I went home and sorted out my 5 minutes, got up and did my stuff, and I had such a reaction as I'd never had before. It was wonderful. And then somebody got up and apologised for me, said, sorry, we don't normally have this kind of act here, and I was very upset. So I did a few more of those.
Imagine how it feels to be a woman going into these places.
Yeah.
With a guitar. You play guitar as part of your act.
Yes. Yeah. So it, I did that for a few months, and it upset me so much that I stopped for 10 years, and then the next time was I came back and sat in the audience at the Cosmic Comedy Club for 18 months on Tuesdays.
Wow.
Looking at the new acts, because as you say, I do find new acts encouraging. They make me feel like I'm quite good. So I sat there for 18 months plucking up the courage to get up and do it.
Tell your own material.
Yes, I still didn't quite tell my own material, so that I'm a very slow learner.
That makes a good point, though, about competitions, regardless of all women or any other competition. You know, that whole leap of faith of being able to get up there. You know, competitions provide that environment because, you know you're going to be with a load of other people who feel probably exactly the same as you. And it's a level playing field.
See, I think competitions are scarier than going on to do a regular show.
Well, it depends
because
how
people are deciding whether that specific person, all the other people on the show, are better than you.
There's a big debate going on about competitions. It's been in the press, and obviously I got involved in that because I run a competition. I mean, to be honest with you, the way What Funny Women is panning out now, the competition is important. But it, you know, actually, I know it sounds terribly trite. It's not about the winning. It's about taking part. I think a lot of the women who've taken part in the competition would back me up on that. Actually.
I feel that way about competitions because I've never won one.
Yeah. Well, but I don't know whether that necessarily applies to the other competitions. I feel they are more competitive. The all comers ones. And obviously, we could get very heavily into the debate about Perrier's, but probably best not.
No, we should.
I've got the list, by the way, in my notebook.
Well, so come on to that in a minute.
I noticed something that you might not have noticed, Sabrina, that we have a theme moving from left to right here of 10-year layoffs. Bad experiences, and then taking it says about a dozen things about the sensibility of a person who wants to be a comedian.
Yeah.
It tells the recklessness, the humiliation, the time that you're willing to bide your time, you're still, your eye is just looking for that opportunity to segue back into it. I mean, it's pretty fascinating. I'm better than you guys. I only took 4 years off.
No, actually, I'm glad you said that, because as you were talking about the funny women, I thought one of the problems with a lot of competitions, I find, is the fact that a lot of people will do stand-up comedy just to go in the competition.
Yeah.
And maybe there should be like a little kind of an email just to say...
You have to vet them.
Yeah.
You know, we're quite careful about who we let into the competition.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. But I was saying, but maybe it'd be a nice idea to say to people, maybe it might be a good idea if you do the competition after a year of performing.
Yeah.
Because things like, say, you think you're funny, I didn't realise, I did it after only about 20 gigs. And found out that's my one and only chance.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if I'd done it a year later, I could have maybe at least got to the final or got, you know, I think maybe if it's something like Laughing Horse, then they say as long as they haven't paid you, then you can do it as many times as you want.
Well, our girls have 3 years at it.
Yeah.
So if they don't get in through, I mean, and actually the girl who won this year has done the competition 2 years on the trot. And, you know, and I think that's quite a good way to do it, so you kind of.
But you use your competition as much as a platform to see female comedy
and
rather
scouting,
than who's...
And you encourage maybe some people that didn't win the last time to come back again.
We invite them back.
That's good. Because I found some acts I know who've got to like finals of competitions because they started and they luckily got to the final. They suddenly just stop because they didn't win.
Well, the girls that all get into the final can't enter again into the main competition, but I can tell you, we booked most of the acts who've got into our three finals. We're still booking.
Okay.
Do you have a kind of an annex program for like males with small genitals?
We could.
Another competition I can't enter.
Yeah, and then maybe the small women's competition.
Are there as many competitions in New York as there are in London?
No, they're not.
Because for those of you who don't know, there must be about 20-odd comedy competitions around Britain every year.
Yeah, Phil Klein had one, remember? He had Phil Academy.
The Phil Academy.
We were going to have a competition for the second worst comedian. I don't think anybody would. They would go in for it.
Of course they would. No, yeah, I've got an act on the wall. Bill Hack.
It's the second worst. Yeah. You know, the worst comedian, you know, I guess would win by acclamation, but the second worst, difficult to ascertain.
Yeah. Because that's the real winner. But actually, you still give the prize to the worst one to make the second winner feel really bad.
No, I think the worst one should be a mystery.
Okay.
Because everybody could make their own minds up.
Oh, no, that's good.
The worst is ever changing, but the second remains constant.
Yes.
Oh, that's good. So if you're brilliant in the competition,
like
you don't go to the next round.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, the second worst comedian in the world.
Yeah.
How about a mediocrity competition?
Yes, yeah. I can find you a few entrants.
So, a quick round of voting, hands raised voting. Who do you think has been the most honest? Mike Belgrave. Sorry, Mike. Brian Damage. Andrew J. Ledra.
Oh,
very good. Lynn Parker.
Oh.
Yay!
It's not fair because she's not offending enough to be dishonest. And then the other thing about that is that when you're not trying to get laughs, you sound honest. She could be handing you a bill of goods with that smiling 2 years to build a business face. We're twisting things for laughs, but it's all the truth, folks.
I wasn't here to begin, so I didn't realize it was about honesty and dishonesty, so I was being honest.
You were the second most honest.
I was the second most honest.
Right, next question. I'm going to start off with Brian. Have you ever felt, because I think this is a brilliant one for you, have you ever felt bad for another performer?
Yeah. Yeah. Most of the people at our club are new acts, and it's there. We work on the basis that you can come along, you can die on your ass consistently, and you're still welcome to come back. Because most, a lot of the comedy circuit is highly selective in the type of act. You know, it's possible to go somewhere, die on your ass, and you probably won't even get another open spot for 2-3 years, which I think is ridiculous.
So we
want to encourage, because I gave it up for 10 years, I want to encourage people to keep doing it.
Mm.
It's fantastic. Part of the buzz of it is seeing somebody when they start off thinking, what the hell are they on about? And then 2 years later, they're still sort of on the same tack, but now they've suddenly got it, and people are laughing, and you can see people who are funny right away. Some people are funny just straight away. They've got it, even they haven't left school yet, and they're funny.
Mm.
But other people, it takes a time, and when they've got it, it's wonderful.
Do you make them stop coming back once they're good?
No. We've got a promotion. You know, they get 10 minutes or 15 minutes. But I mean,
a door split.
And the money is irrelevant. You know, how do you divide £5?
I just picture you apologising to the audience. And we have to apologise. We let everybody on here, but we're sorry. This guy's really not lousy enough for the sensibility that we've tried to encourage here.
But you literally have people who are virtually out of the asylum for the gig, and then they go back into the bin, and then they come out the following week to do it.
We do have people who have been...
You absolutely don't discriminate.
No, it's deliberate.
Yeah, you actually have people that maybe your gig is the only one that will actually still book them because you've been banned from everywhere else.
Well, they do actually behave because basically.
I mean, I won't say any names basically, but there is an act that's more or less been banned from everywhere. But every time he does go to your gig, he really does behave himself because it is the last bastion of him for comedy, really.
There's nowhere else to go.
No, you know, Lynn, as open as their policy is, no women.
Oh, right.
We always have.
He's a double act.
We have very few women.
Yeah, but you do have some transvestites.
You
have a few transvestites.
And women do get preferential treatment if they phone up looking for a gig.
I've got people looking for gigs.
I'm actually on the board of Pear Shape, aren't I?
You both are.
We're both
position to be shouted at by people. I think is that my position?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sabrina and I'll send you a few.
I'm bored with Pear Shaped also.
What about you, Andrew De La Rey? Have you ever felt bad for somebody, about a performer?
Yes, but, you know, not that frequently and not that deeply. Because, you know, I got my own troubles.
Because the sort of performer I feel bad for is the ones that actually do turn up at the Pear Shape frequently. They're ones who are psychologically unbalanced.
Yeah.
In many, many respects. And they just say too much and they expose too much and they really do think comedy is terrible.
Yeah, but you know what? They're happier than you are. They have no clue what they're doing. They're the people you should least feel sorry for. They're the broken and happy.
Yeah.
You got perspective on life. You're a miserable wretch. You're a lunatic. Everything's glory.
Yeah, I want to be like that.
Leaving the pair crying. Why didn't they laugh?
I see, if you have a look on Chortle, you see, there's quite a lot of people on there that say, oh, so-and-so, this fella, he's deranged, you know, somebody should tell him, you know, he shouldn't be allowed to gig. Who has the right to do that?
Yeah. And usually, maybe you should have a staff doctor on the board of Pear Shape to actually decide whether someone's healthy enough
Brian.
To do it.
It's me. If they turn up, they're healthy enough. Yeah.
We had a guy at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles. There used to be a guy who was every Monday night, which was the open night. His name was Bob Aprovia. And I think he had been like an attorney. He was like a really kind of accomplished guy. I don't know, drug casualty or something, like Jim on Taxi. But he did an uncannily eerie psychotic's impression of Johnny Carson. I mean, he didn't call it an impression. It was, I'm Bob Aprovia, but his whole style, everything was modeled after Johnny Carson. And he would go up every week and do his version of a Johnny Carson monologue, and everybody else would sit and mock him and, you know, maybe even throw things at him and mean, hostile comments. But for him, he was reveling in it. You know what I mean? This was his forum every week. You know, in those few minutes, he was Johnny Carson, who was the, you know, big deal chat show host in America for 30 years. And, you know, he couldn't look at you in the eye when he'd be in the hallway between shows. He was, like, you know, bouncing up and down. He had, like, a Rasputin beard and wild hair. And he'd, like, turn away when you walked past him. But he'd walk up there on stage and do all the ticks and the things with the lapels and whatever. And it's like, and I felt for him. I didn't feel sorry for him. Yeah. I felt for him. And yet, in a way, he was having a fairly good life, at least in those moments, you know. He was an entertainer.
I've just had so many people that suggest that certain people shouldn't do it, and I just think that's so wrong.
Oh, it is wrong.
Anybody can do it, and that's what I love about the comedy circuit, is the lunatics that I mix with. I love them. So how can you... I've never met so many deranged, needy...
Well, have you ever noticed that there's nothing in the world so supremely confident as the eyes of a truly bad performer?
Yes. Yes.
What about you, Lynn?
I think the worst... I do feel sorry for them. The competition, because I see... Well, this year we saw 150-odd new acts. So, you know, there were a lot of... The one that sticks out in my mind was not from this year, it was from last year when we were in Glasgow, actually. We had normally about 10 to 14 acts a night in a showcase. These two girls showed up. They were early. They arrived about 3 hours before the gig, and they had a great big bag with them, a guitar with them, a big long stick. And I always get nervous about props. I always think, oh, God, props, too many props. Anyway, you know, very sweet. Oh, can we go and change? Is there a changing room? And it was a typical comedy gig. There was nowhere to change or anything. So they got to squeeze themselves into the ladies' loo, and they got... Anyway, they disappeared for about an hour to get into their costumes. And they then, you know, the show started, and I think they were on about fourth or fifth. Well, they must have whipped themselves into such a nervous frenzy, because by the time they went on stage, I kid you not, they were in these matching sort of T-shirts. I can't remember what it said on them, but they had some funny words on them. They had a broom. They had a bucket. They had a guitar. They had something else. I can't remember what it was. But there was all these props, and they were all on the stage. And they got on stage, and they looked at each other, and we'd set up two mics like this. And they obviously were so terrified. They just like, no one could even hear what they were saying. They were like talking to each other. And they lasted about 2 minutes. And then they just took a bow and went off. And I did feel sorry for them.
I like the fact that they took a bow.
Yes. Yeah, they took a bow. But they clearly had gone on with some great idea that they probably rehearsed in the toilet about 3 million times. Yeah. And it was obviously fear. I think they had really, you know, just... And I did feel really sorry for them. And well, they didn't hang
always,
around either.
It's always funny in your head anyway, isn't it, when you come up with a crackpot idea.
Oh, yeah,
it is,
yeah.
Do you remember that guy that turned up a Pear Shape dressed as a mattress, and he literally had a mattress in his head through it? A massive mattress.
That's
and
funny.
He carried it on the chair.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah. There was two of them.
That's right.
It was two of them. They both had mattresses.
Real bed mattresses.
It didn't look like they were in pyjamas, so it's like they were lying in bed.
Oh,
yeah. But they never mentioned it.
Oh, no.
This sounds like a great act.
Yeah, they just talked for 5 minutes. It didn't make any sense what they were talked about.
Oh, I loved it.
And they just walk off again. And the audience would be bemused, you know. They were great, though.
These great big mattresses. Well, they go back down to the tube and go home again.
I think girls for your club, actually.
Oh, please,
I think they were brilliant.
They sound great. What about, I had a fellow turn up one time. He said to me, he said, oh, he turned up about an hour before. I'm trying to set the room up. And he kept talking to me and bothering me. And, and he said, you will let me know before I go on. Let me know before I go on. And I said, well, what do you actually do? Oh, musical, character. So I thought, right, he's got to change. So I announced him, and he walked out onto the stage, totally naked, with just a guitar slung up here, right? And he stood on the stage, and people were, as you are now, they were at eye level with his small penis, if I can use a better word. And he did 10 minutes of quite... In those days, I used to let him do 10 minutes. Now it's 5 minutes, right? So it doesn't matter how good they are, 5 minutes. And he did 10 minutes of... actually, quite good material, but people were just
looking at him.
Mine's bigger than that.
Distracted.
It was just such a peculiar. And he got a booking at another club out of it.
Yeah, a nudist club. You. My friend Andy is doing the naked comedy. I'm holding this up for the radio audience to see.
Yeah.
My friend Andy O'Feish is doing the naked comedy showcase tonight. No guitars, only nakedness. And I've actually, because Spank, the show Spank at the Underbelly, has been having people come up naked. They get a minute to promote their shows. So I've actually seen some of the people who are going to be on the show tonight naked. And some of them have very large and long penises, and some of them don't. And there's a clown on the show. And Victor from the Nigerian Spam Scam Scam, and Dean Cameron, the old teen movie actor who wrote it, they're gonna act out the Aristocrats joke naked and then tape it and send it to Paul Provenza for the DVD. So it could be a good thing. And Victor, swizzled Brendan Burns' drink with his penis one night at Spank.
Did he?
Brendan drank it. So the Naked Comedy Showcase, which is tonight at 8...
Boy, that's funny, isn't it?
Tonight at 8:10 at the Smirnoff Baby Belly.
You know I'm a female actor. Can do that.
Yeah.
See, this is why women aren't women, because they can't swizzle.
It's all in someone's drink.
Could I just say, I could stir two barrels with my accoutrements.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Mike Belgrave, have you ever felt sorry for a performer?
Have I ever felt sorry for a performer? No, because I think half the battle and the point of doing comedy is the fact that you actually had the balls to get up there and do it in the first place. If you've been really bad and you're awful, with a penis or a vagina or bosoms.
Bosoms are not funny.
It can be hilarious. You've not seen Benny Hill.
It's what you do with them, but you need a man reacting to bosoms. Bosoms to be funny.
Hey, I quite like when a woman reacts to bosoms as well. But let's not talk about my video collection. I don't feel sorry for any performer. I think, yes, you've got the balls, you've got the breasts to get up there.
And all you need now is the jokes.
And some buttocks. Right. Yes. No, because I just think, I love a death. I love to see people die on stage. I think it's great fun. Sometimes I know audiences who actually will talk to me after a gig, and they will come up to me if I'm emceeing, and they only talk about the person that died. Because in a way, the audience love it more, and I think that's part of the entertainment. Yeah. As long as I think it's when people are being cruel. No, that's great as well. Sorry, when someone's is a brilliant show, somebody goes on right in the middle, and you see sometimes audiences are lovely, they're cheering, they're loving it, they're one of the nicest audiences ever, but there's only so far that people can be nice, and then someone goes on as bad, and just the audience go, right, for this next 5 minutes we're going to turn into a bunch of bastards, really. And they do it, and they just turn on an act, and it's hilarious to see it, and everyone starts booing, and they do the slow hand clapping off, and when they got off the stage they're all cheering because the MC's come back on, and the MC goes, you bunch of bastards, that's really cruel, and they all laugh, and the next act goes on and they're back to normal again. And I think that's fantastic. But I think, that's all the whole point of it. If you can't take that, don't do it. But if you go up there and take it, and I don't feel sorry for them. I just think, no, good for you for getting up there and doing it. Because I've died on my bars loads of times. And I hope other acts and other audiences and members find it equally as entertaining. Mm. So I'm on the other side. So I don't feel sorry for
anyone. There's a theory. I don't know if you know this. you talk about how audiences can only be good for so long. Mm. It's human nature that people want to really cull the herd,
yeah,
turn on,
yeah,
someone, and choose Piggy, you know, to kill and eat. And it is human nature. And there's a theory that one of the reasons that England did not go fascist between World War I and World War II is that they had stand-up comedy and music hall, so that people had the opportunity to express their viciousness in a wholesome and safe environment.
Okay.
Whereas Germany, which didn't have, they had the cabaret with its damning satiric musical comedy sketches, but they didn't have the kind of comedy where people could vent their hostility. And so eventually it built to the point where they had to kill 6 million Jews.
Andrew, who wrote that
theory? I did right now while I'm up here.
It's a brilliant story. Us from being a fascist country. Yeah. There we go.
But I do.
And bosoms are the other reason.
Yeah, yeah.
Great.
We like bosoms in this country. Yeah.
It's a fantastic word.
But then there's the variant like bazooms.
Hooters.
Gazangas is always good.
No, hooters and bosoms are the best.
Yes.
Isn't that from The Wizard of Oz?
Hooters
and bosoms and bears. Oh my.
No, but I do think cruelty has a big part to play in comedy, and it's
definitely.
Watching a comic get it wrong. I mean, I won't name his name, but there's a certain act who's French, and he used to throw mic stands at the audience, and I thought that was possibly a bit too far. Possibly, well, I don't know. You didn't ban him, but.
We've never managed to ban anybody yet, but the only thing I will say is don't touch the audience.
We've actually stopped people.
Well, you know who I'm talking about, who came along and she used to take a dead fish out of her pants and throw it, and this poor fellow was sitting about there and he got this fish smack in the face, and it was terrible. So from then on, throw nothing at the audience, don't touch them.
Yeah.
You know.
Are you allowed to dive from the stage?
No, don't throw yourself.
We've done that at our shows. Mrs. Barbara Nice is famous for her crowd surfing at our gigs.
Have
you seen her do that? Don't touch the audience, she just. I mean, obviously we need a slightly larger audience than this, but she just launches herself.
This is a huge audience.
You're good enough. I actually launched myself at you. If the radio mics were not tethered to you.
Would you like to give us a demonstration?
No, I wouldn't know. But the other thing I was just going to add on about performing is Joe Caulfield, of whom I am a huge fan.
Mm-hmm.
We were having a chat one day about, what makes you do it and this whole subject. And she said, you are only a performer when you can stop being embarrassed. She said, because if you get embarrassed, just don't do it. And it's this whole thing about dying on stage. You've got to be prepared. Because actually, I mean, I'll be honest with you, I find that very embarrassing. I would hate it, which is why I can't do it.
That's why so many dysfunctional people become comedians. They're already embarrassed.
Yeah,
walking through life is a humiliating experience. Mm. How much worse can it be doing it in front of people where you might have a modicum of control?
That's a very good point.
Well, I still get embarrassed if I'm out there and all of a sudden I realise that I'm in a situation that there is nothing I can do about it. I've tried everything. Then I do have a certain amount of embarrassment. But I know that the audience, that they love a good struggle, and I do like to watch somebody on stage who's dug themselves into such a hole.
After a while you're thinking,
go on, I can get out of that. Right? But when they do, and they turn the audience, that's a wonderful thing.
Interesting, because Joe is quite a slick, confident performer, and I believe she doesn't get embarrassed, but she must have done in the early
days. She's very thin, and I think that you get embarrassed when you're thin. It's been my experience that when I'm thin I get embarrassed less. You're talking about a specific case. We're talking about comedy now in terms of the gladiatorial comedy that takes place in clubs, but I think that in the larger realm of personal visions and things that you want to maybe poke through to the bigger audiences out there who aren't sitting waiting to see people dig themselves out of holes in clubs.
Mm.
I've seen, I don't know what it's like here, I know there's a great heckling ethic in the UK, but I've seen comedians...
Is it more so than New York?
Much
really?
More so than in the United States.
Much
and because there's a lot more drunkenness here than there is in the United States.
They don't tend to drink so much,
right.
Do they, in the clubs?
No. But, or anywhere. But, the thing is, I've seen people who show up at a comedy place in the beginning, when they're just showing up out of wherever it is, whatever cabbage patch new comedians come from, and they're really odd in wondrous ways. They have strange speech rhythms, and their thoughts are unfathomably wonderful. And I've seen some of them be destroyed by their increasing competence at working effectively in a heckler-laden club environment. Mm. They become effective jousters, effective gladiators, but they winnow away from themselves in that and other ways the thing that made them interesting and probably would have given them a greater shot at the larger success that often eludes people who are great in those environments.
And I'm thinking a classic example would be someone like Woody Allen when he started. If he had to go to some of the really heavy-duty London, Glasgow, Newcastle clubs,
well,
he would have slit his throat, but he would never have come with that really amazingly clever, bright, fresh comedy. And I think that's going on to the next subject, which, well, it's something that people will answer in different ways, but based on the new law that we can't do, that people can't incite religious hatred.
Oh, that's disgusting. I can't believe how disgusting.
Can I finish the question?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, actually, I didn't do the vote. Can we have a quick vote for who's been the most honest? Lynn Parker, by raise of hands. Andrew J. Lederer, who talked the most. Brian Damage. Way! Well done. And Mike Belgrove. Well, I nearly split the vote on that one.
I am honestly perplexed by your reaction.
So based on that, the law of religious incitement to religious hatred coming into being, and lots of comics have made comments on it, and I'm quite frankly not too bothered. The next question, which I'll answer myself to give you thinking time, is what law would we like to have introduced in our performance arena? My law would be, if I had the power, would be to make every comedy venue 50-50 split between the sexes, male-female ratio. That would be my law. Andrew.
Laws are dumb. I mean, you know, laws are important to keep people from, you know, murdering and raping willy-nilly, who used to be murdered and raped on a regular basis. He was a Groundhog Day kind of character, a Flying Dutchman who would come back to life only to be murdered and raped again. But, no, you know what, you can't say this. You got to be good. If squelching speech is the first step toward creating a German land of no Max Millers and mass executions.
I wouldn't squelch speech. I'd have male, female, and everybody could talk as much as they like.
Oh, that'd I was be... talking about the original religious thing, sorry. Your rule is just stupid.
Okay, what would you have? None. No laws.
No, gender equality. Let people battle it out on a field of their own ambitions.
I'm actually with him on this one, by the way. I agree with you.
You can't, you know, we learned from the fall of the Soviet Union that you can't have central planning.
Right.
So, you know, just let things happen the way they happen. If you don't like it, work it out in some kind of devious, passive-aggressive way where you, you know, find some justice in the world by making someone miserable and they won't even know it was you.
Lynn, what law would you bring into...
Well, I'm afraid I'm anti your law, which... because I just think women have got to get there on their own merit, and no law will change things, quite frankly. And I don't agree with the blasphemy thing either. I just think it's we live in a free society, and a comedy club is somewhere where, you know, as you, Andrew's mentioned about wartime Britain and chance to vent off your spleen, you know, I mean, what better place than in a comedy club to, you know, have a bit of religious, anti-religious fervour or whatever. And if you haven't seen Stuart Lee's show yet, that's the biggest backlash against the shit he's been through over blasphemy. But you know, if you get shocked,
he's the guy that helped write and direct
Jerry Springer and
Jerry Springer the opera.
Look, as we know, there's no shame in hating people just because they're different from you.
But the law
only in doing something about it.
The law I would like to see, and what it is coming in actually, is that I'm sorry, it's the no smoking thing, because I just think the health thing really. And
you'll like it, just like in the States, everybody bitches about it at first, and then they all
get
like
used
it.
To it. Yeah. So that's about it really for my laws.
I did a gig in Melbourne, a big club, about 500-600 seater. In Melbourne, they've got a really odd anti-smoking policy in that you can smoke within 10 foot of the bar. So the bar was at the back of this huge, huge room, the Hi-Fi Bar in Melbourne, you know, it's a huge room, and there was about 200 people, and they were all like this, trying to smoke. And the front row was made up of a couple of asthmatics, and you had to do more comedy right in the back of the room. And there's this massive, empty space, except for the few people wheezing away at the front. Law, Mike Belgrave, what law would you
What law would I have? Yeah, I wouldn't want sort of split male, female, because I think the trouble with things like that is then someone will say, well, we want sort of an element of black people, we want Indian people.
Exactly.
Then you'll actually end up having a gig where, because they want to fill the criteria, you're going to have a bit where you've got three, you know, white males who are brilliant because they've had to all kind of go for that spot. And then the rest of them are absolutely crap because they've just literally just had to fill the spaces because the decent black person people are all gigging elsewhere. So you're literally getting some open spot to fill that. And it could be a big gig where everyone's paid 15 quid and that's just not on. So I wouldn't go with that at all.
But I'm seeing gig after gig where there are exclusively white males aged between 23 and 28.
But
and there is always a massively weaker comic.
It's historic.
There are more men doing comedy.
There's
more white males to every two women.
It's not on the open spot circuit. It's much bigger, and then it narrows as they fall off because they can't get the gigs.
I still think we're still very outnumbered.
I don't think promoters are prejudiced. I find more promoters tend to, because I used to promote a gig, and actually the one I originally did was. I'd always prioritise women, and I'd always give women two gigs, and I'd always give the men one gig. They'd have to do the gig, then book again, but women always get two bookings at a time, and I'd always leave a couple of spaces per gig. And a lot of promoters do that.
But only book the women if they're good.
Oh, no, this was completely open spot. This was like Brian's gig. It was completely open, so I wanted to be as encouraging as possible. And I think that's okay. You know, I'm not saying literally it has to be male, female. I'm just saying as an open spot thing, it's a good idea. But if I had to have a law, my law would be I think people should be allowed to smoke weed in a comedy gig because I think people smoking weed, they'd be really laughing their heads.
Isn't that for
really
some of the comedians if there wasn't adequate ventilation? Because if I could perform drunk, but if I smoke pot, I see my ideas, the things I was going to say, like about several inches away from where I can get. The thought is still there. I can see it in my head, but I can't reach out and grab it. It's like a leaf just, you know, being blown wispily out of my grasp.
Okay, good ventilation then, and you can smoke weed.
Anti-tobacco, pro-weed.
Yes, yes.
And what about you, Brian?
I wouldn't introduce a law. I wouldn't have one.
Completely lawless zone. What about touching people?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't make it a law. I wouldn't have them back if they insisted. You just say.
How about this law? No laws.
Yes.
A law mandating that there be no laws relating to the comedy realm.
Total anarchy.
All right. Yeah. But there has to be a law mandating the anarchy. And if the anarchy is not maintained, you're in violation of the law.
Yes.
Okay.
Right, very, very good. That got a massive
round
of applause.
That's just what I was
going to say. A quick vote on honesty then. Who's been the most honest on this round? Lynn Parker. Andrew J. Ledger. And Brian.
Wait,
that's definitely a split vote. And
I've got a vote for having no opinion.
No, yeah.
Right, I'm going to stop asking questions now. Is there any questions from the audience that they'd like to ask anybody who's up here? Any unanswered questions? Are you two, what would you like to ask?
Do you all write your own material and do you have a set theme?
Well, I write her material.
Shush, this is a proper...
He writes my...
Mike Belgrave.
Yes, I do write all my own material. And I don't really have a set theme generally. I think my theme is just generally based around the fact that I like to be quite jolly. I want the audience to like me. I don't really want to offend anyone. When I mean offend anyone, I mean you may get offended by the jokes, but I don't want to literally offend individuals. Like, you know, if you shout to me and heckle, and I'll put you down, but I won't go on and on and on about it. I hope that you would laugh at my put down, and then once you get quiet, then I'll move on, you know. But that's what I do, I write everything myself.
Because one of your heroes is Frankie Howard, isn't he?
Yes, he is, actually. I love Frankie Howard. He's brilliant.
What about you, Brian?
Yes, I write my own material. Now. And I do find that some people coming onto the circuit, if they've done like mainstream gigs, they'll phone me up and say, can I do a spot? You know, and I actually don't care what they do, as long as it's their own stuff. And sometimes you get somebody coming, oh, well, you know, if they can't take a few like proper jokes, then, you know, fuck them. And I'll say, well, sorry, mate, look, the idea of this, you coming along telling old jokes is the equivalent of going to an original songwriter's night and singing an obscure Beatles song and getting a big round of applause for it. So you're going to piss off the other acts, and it's just the idea, and it's fun. And on the basis that people write their own material, I think they're entitled not to be funny every now and then, because you have to find out if it works.
What's your topics?
Yes. My topics?
What's the areas?
Oh, sex, filth, stupid stuff, the rare Patagonian toothfish.
Very good song.
Yeah. I don't do anything of any relevance, just to...
Death.
Hmm?
For countrysides and farmyards and things. You've got a few songs about those, haven't you?
Very basic stuff. Yeah. Very basic stuff.
You've got one about the audience, haven't you?
Yeah. But it's musical.
It's musical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mine tends to be stories and anecdotes about things that have happened in my real life, like I am a white-collar criminal. Just not for today, one day at a time, as they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm being honest. But that's where I get my stuff from. What about you, Andrew?
I don't write because I can't. I mean, I'm a good writer. I write for other non-stand-up things, but I can't. And I've written jokes for other people, but I can't write. I have to be free to just talk on stage, and I generate tremendous amounts of material, which I then forget. And it's to the detriment of my show. You know, I got these good reviews in the first week of my show. I bought this digital voice recorder so that I could like remember things, so I could remember to say them again. But then I got it all clogged up after a few days, and I don't have the program to put the stuff off of this thing and onto the computer. So now I can't record my show. So I'll do a great show. You know, I'm going to remember everything I said. And then the next night, what was that again? You know, stumbling through it. You know, reaching out for those wispy leaves of ideas, like I was in one of your stoner rooms. So, yeah, but I suppose in the context in which you ask the question, I write my own material because I don't do, you know, his material. And as far as topics, well, the topic of my show, my multiple four-star winning show, Me and Hitler, which is at the Smirnoff Baby Belly every night at 9:25, and I need your help to whittle down the thousands of dollars paid by him. The subject is Me and Hitler. Generally speaking, it's more me than Hitler.
Mm-hmm. So do you generally talk about things that happen in your own life experience? Because Mike definitely doesn't. Mike talks about just anything that strikes you as funny.
Yeah,
it's not. Mm-hmm.
I take sort of tiny little thing that happened to me, like when I, you know, that joke I do about boxing. I did actually hit it, hurt my wrist, and I have this whole mad story that goes around, and it just comes from a very, very tiny, tiny little thing.
You got a bruise once.
I got a slight bruise, but it goes to me breaking my wrist, and it goes with my doctor and people shouting at me and stuff, you know.
Did it really happen?
All it did is I hit the boxing bag, it just hurt my wrist a little bit, and I went, oh, that's an idea for a joke.
Yeah.
And it just goes over, I broke my wrist on the time I hit it, and it's all with doctor and people shouting.
See, I have a comedy creed.
Comes into
a comedy creed.
Yeah.
It's actually posted on my wall of ideals. And my comedy creed is to tell the truth as close to the way it actually happened as possible with a minimum of exaggeration and still have it be funny. So I try not to start from the outrageous and scale it back, because then you may never get back to the most minimalist nub of actual. I start with the raw, unbelievably tedious actual details and then try and work to the point where it becomes funny. So, you know, buyer beware.
Lynn?
Well, I don't write any material, really, but I'll just make a general comment on comics and material. I think those of us in the industry, I've not been in the industry too long, so I don't consider myself a real expert, but I pretty well could tell if someone wasn't using their own material. And I think, you know, you obviously all... I think if you're a really good comic, you write your own experiences or as you say, ideas that pop into your head. That's how I would expect, and I think I've seen a few shows up here actually, where I just know that person has not written their own material, and that's fine. I don't have much effectively have a problem with that if it's good, but or if it's done in a context that it's a piece of entertainment. But a stand-up getting up and doing jokes that someone else has written for them, I intrinsically have a bit of a problem with, because when you buy into stand-up, you're buying into that person's reputation, image, whatever.
But that's a modern concept. I mean, decades ago, some of the best, most amazing comedians. I think you could make the argument that in some ways they were finer creations and funnier than, you know, the great vast, you know, majority of
that's
people.
What I think
they
comics
were produced,
now get,
weren't they? Yeah. I mean,
self-produced,
quite,
though.
Yeah,
I mean, they were their own. I mean, they were in charge of their own character empires, you know.
But I think that's one of the things that I find, again, going back to what Lynn was saying, is that there's some comics like me who talk about myself, my own stories, things that have actually happened to me, and try and make them vaguely amusing. But there's other people like Mike, but it's still Mike's view of the world.
Yes.
Even though, you know, it's not about him and his life, it's still his view of the world. You look at Eddie Izzard, for instance, who come off, when he comes off stage, you don't really know any more about his life, but you certainly know about his view of the world, and it's completely absurd and mad, but it's totally Eddie. It's not, you know, Ross Noble, who's often compared to him, has a completely different view, even though he does quite, again, you come off and you know vaguely that he's possibly a Geordie. And that he travels a bit, but apart from that, you don't really know much more facts about his life, but you know his view of what he thinks about various things and how he reacts to certain things. Brian never talks about himself, do you, Danny?
No.
But what you don't know about the Patagonian toothfish is just not worth knowing. And on that note, thank you very much for coming, and yes, I hope you've enjoyed it. And if you want to ask any other questions from anyone, we've got another show coming in here in 10 minutes. Meet us upstairs and we'll have a drink with you up there. Talk about it more. Thanks very much for coming. Round of applause for your selves.